You're listening to Ten Radio, broadcasting on 105.3 FM and streaming on the net. Coming up shortly is our next in the series of election interviews. I'm Barry Alloway, and a warm welcome to today's election interview. As you probably know, this week, Ten Radio are interviewing all five candidates for the Taunton Deane constituency, and today is the turn of the Labour candidate, Martin Jevon. Hello, Martin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and I do hope that you have an enjoyable interview.
Well, we'll try our best. It's a pleasure to be back here at Ten Radio.
Good. Now, you've stood before, haven't you?
I have indeed. I was the parliamentary candidate back in 2010, and I think you've had a move since then to your new premises here near the school, but you made me very, very welcome, and I had a very, very in-depth interview, and it's a pleasure to be back to be grilled once more.
Grilled. Well, we'll see what we can do. Lightly poached, possibly. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about your background for those listeners who don't know you?
Oh, certainly. Well, I'm a Taunton person, and I've been here in Taunton Deane since the age of two. I went to school at Lady Mead, as it was then, although it's the Taunton Academy now, off to Somerset College of Art and Technology, and then I went to Luton Polytechnic, which possibly reveals a little bit about my age now, just before it got turned into a university. And that's when I got really involved in politics, because that was the first year that the Conservative government introduced student loans. I was a non... I did not get a grant. So moving on from there, a wide variety of things. I did 10 years as an entertainer for Thompson Holidays, more recently here in sort of back in Taunton and across the county, working for a health charity, providing advice and support, and now I work for a care organisation.
Right, thank you very much. A very neat potted history. Now, since you last stood, which I think was 2010, obviously there have been an awful lot of changes. What do you think has changed as far as you personally are concerned that might give you an edge at this election?
Well, we've had 7 years of so-called austerity, which I think has, in my opinion, not proven to be the panacea that the Tories and the Lib Dems, as they were in coalition in 2010 across to 2015, felt that it was. I mean, we've seen a lot of social issues. We've had stresses within the health and social care system. We've seen a freeze on public sector workers' wages, and all in the name of austerity, but we've seen the national debt rise to catastrophic and extremely high levels.
Yeah, we have. But do you think you have an edge now compared to then?
Well, we've got a very wide range of policies, and we've been much more explicit in sort of setting out the fact that we want to renationalise some national industries. We want to reinvest and put more money back into the NHS. My passion has always been health and social care, and obviously one of the things that I'm extremely concerned about is the fact that our current care organisations professions and industry are struggling hard to meet the demand, which then pushes pressures back up to the NHS. We can't keep on squeezing the care services, especially if we want people to have a dignity of life and care if they are going to remain at home, or even if they're trying to find a place in a care facility.
Okay, well, we'll obviously come on to that a bit later on. I've actually had a chance to look at your manifesto, which is very interesting. It's very well put together, if I may say so. Just looking at a few quotations from it, in his introduction, Jeremy Corbyn says, "Labour will invest in cutting-edge jobs and industries that can improve everybody's lives." Now, what do you think that means for our constituency?
Well, here in Taunton Deane, we are a very unique constituency because we have a blend of urban and rural. When we talk about Taunton Deane, we just don't talk about Taunton. And that's a mistake I think some of the other candidates make. Obviously, we have our Wellington, we have Wiveliscombe, and we have the much more rural areas, Milverton and the surrounding villages. I'm big fan of the 10 parishes, it has to be said, and I've been involved in a number of things sort of out here.
Right.
But the fact is that we don't have sort of much in the way of big industry, and the reality is that in an area like this, we need sustainable jobs, but we need local jobs as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reality that rural living means that the jobs that people do need to be local, or they have to end up travelling great distances.
But we're not exactly cutting edge. That's what he was specifically saying in his introduction there, cutting edge jobs, and we're not really a high tech area. So do you think our area would benefit very much from what he's talking about there?
Well, I think cutting edge, it sounds like it's technology.
It does, doesn't it?
It sounds like it's interesting, but the reality is there can be, cutting edge doesn't have to be all about technology. Cutting edge can be innovative, entrepreneurial.
I agree. Yeah.
It can be it can be an idea in a head that needs help in germinating. And one of the things that we've also said within the manifesto is the fact that we'd be looking to introduce a national education service, which is cradle to grave. And we're not just saying that sort of education has to come to a stop once you leave school or college or university. It's about reintroducing opportunities for adult education and about reskilling.
Okay, thank you.
I'll do one little thing there. Jobs change over the years, and the skills need to change.
Yeah.
So you need the opportunities to re-educate and relearn as life goes on.
Okay, right. Thank you very much. Something else which Jeremy says in his introduction to this manifesto is, I quote, "Young people are being held back by debt." Now, what do you think he means when he says that?
Well, we've talked about education very, very briefly.
Mm.
If you look at your average university student who leaves university with hundreds of, potentially hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of debt, so, you've got a sort of issue there, which as soon as you start into the working life, you've got to repay back. You've also got the fact that the country is in debt, which means that we are underinvesting in our public facilities. We are underinvesting in all of the services and facilities that not only young people but everyone needs.
Well, we can look at the country's situation, but it's the young people in particular I'm focusing right now, Martin. How would your party actually fund that fairly exceptional cost for young people if, in fact, we didn't make them pay for their education?
Okay, so as you've alluded to, we've said that we will axe tuition fees. We will get rid of student loans and reintroduce a maintenance grant. And that also is about reintroducing the education maintenance allowance for people in further education as well. How are we going to pay for that? A number of issues, in particular, when you look at within the education, we've said that we will axe the vanity grammar school. School projects. We will get rid of free schools because they take good money out of the existing education and fund them into small localised schools, which actually is unfair on the whole of the education system.
But are you personally against grammar schools per se?
We've now not had grammar schools in Somerset for
a long time. They used to work, didn't they?
and my experience within secondary modern was an extremely good one. I got a good education. Yes. I went to college. I went to university. I think what we're looking at with grammar schools is that they make for divisive communities.
Okay, right. Well, we'll come on to education a bit later on, but I also went to a secondary modern, and I took O-levels as a result at the end of it, so I came out quite well. Now, let's look at the economy, if we may. Again, I'm quoting from the manifesto. The first quote I have is, "Our National Transformation Fund will deliver the investment that every part of Britain needs. Labour appears to be pledging £250 billion over the next 10 years to upgrade the economy." So how are they going to do that?
Well, let's bring it down to a local level.
Yeah, please.
One of the things that as part of what we're pledging is that actually super fast broadband would come across to all parts of the country by 2022. That's a big investment, a lot of money.
Right.
But it enables local businesses to compete, it enables people to communicate, and it is one of the things that is very interesting. I was at a business hustings last night, mm-hmm. and a lot of people were saying it's the small things around infrastructure that actually cause them the barriers to actually performing. And Labour recognises that, you know, a good economy is a partnership. It's about the people that create wealth, but it's also about the people that work within industry, work within organisations. And the reality is that we've had massive underinvestment. Now, we have said that we're going to raise taxes. There's no denying that. But the taxes that we're looking to raise, whether it's particularly around capital gains, particularly around business, looking at business rates, will be invested back into the economy so that we can actually become a much more powerful and economically viable country.
Okay. The next step, the manifesto, again, sets out the target of eliminating the government's deficit within 5 years. That seems very familiar, doesn't it? The last Labour manifesto sought to do this by more government borrowing, I remember, in order to spend on infrastructure. But the new manifesto envisages a national investment bank, which will bring $250 billion of lending power along the lines of Germany and Nordic countries using private capital finance. Now, that's quite a new thing, isn't it?
Well,
Where's the private capital going to come from, and how are we going to raise it?
Okay. I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that.
Right, okay.
And if we're having a little break later, I may even go onto my iPad and look it up.
I'm simply quoting from the manifesto itself.
But you know, let's be honest. We've got a good idea. We've seen that it works. Mm. In other parts of the world, and I'm all for innovation. I'm all for taking ideas from places where we see that it works. Now, the National Investment Bank, one of the main focuses will be that it will be targeted on providing loans and finance to small and medium-sized enterprises at a local level.
Right.
Because we know that 60% of the wealth that's generated within the country comes from small and medium-sized enterprises. We don't want to be an enemy of business. We want to be an enemy of businesses that do not play fair. And when you start looking at the very, very high end and you see where people are not paying their taxes, and I'm not going to start on Amazon and Starbucks and all the rest of it bashing, because we've done that all before. But when you then come back down to a local level, we recognise that actually the small and medium businesses are important. So we're looking at reintroducing the lower business rates relief rate for small businesses to enable them to sort of work. Because it's all about local. It's about jobs at a local level. It's about, and we talked about the high quality jobs. The reality is, we've got a living wage of less than £8, as mandated by the current government. To live well, you need a minimum of £10. We need to get people's wages higher, because the fact is, then we then have less reliance on the welfare state. But to do that, we need to boost our businesses.
Doesn't, though, equate, doesn't it equate, if you actually increase the living wage to say £10, you are going to increase the costs of those businesses which are producing the wealth in the first place. So isn't that going to feed through to higher costs?
There's a potential for that, yeah. And I, you know, there are always dangers in any economic decision, and you can't and the fact is that we've got. I've said the fact is a lot today.
We all come up with these little phrases. Don't worry.
So the idea is
That's a good one.
The idea is mm-hmm. that no plan ever survives first contact, and we've got big ideas for the country.
Yeah.
We've got massive ideas. We've seen what borrowing and austerity can do. Mm-hmm. Let's change it a little bit. Let's get rid of austerity. Let's see if we can actually sort of bring people's lives, make people's lives a bit better. But also, the fact is that if people's lives are better, they become more productive and they have more money in their pockets to spend. And so actually, there's a circular sort of people's lives start improving.
I can see where you're coming from.
And life starts improving.
Yeah. This sounds, though, this idea that they are going to encourage investment from successful businesses in other businesses to get them successful. That is the way it appears to me, in a sort of a loan situation. I might be wrong, and we'll have to see what you find in the interval.
There's 128 pages of our manifesto.
I've been through it.
I'm not entirely sure I can read it all again in 4 minutes.
I've been through it. I'm trying to pick out some of the points which I found intriguing, actually, and it's interesting to get your clarification on them. The next one I came across was, our fiscal credibility rule states, that's a lovely word, isn't it? Fiscal credibility rule states that the government should not be borrowing for day-to-day spending. Now, that is really a complete U-turn of what you said this time at the last election, isn't it?
Well,
why this change around your thinking? I know, obviously, you have a different leader, but that's the complete reverse from what the last Labour manifesto said.
So, the last Labour manifestos said things. People didn't vote us in. We've listened to.
So, you're trying something else?
We listen to what voters say.
Right.
I mean, we live in a democracy. If we want our ideas to prevail, we have to present ideas that that people will like and vote for. Now, I've been told that our manifesto is the reddest they've ever seen. If you actually look at the details of the manifesto for 2015, details of the manifesto for 2017, details of the manifesto for 2010, there's a lot of very, very similar ideas. The fact is, well, there we go then, is that we've restated a lot of them, but we've actually sort of sat down and listened to the electorate. We've listened to what they want. Now, our ideas are very left-leaning. I make no apology for that. We are a left party, mainly centre-left. But the reality of if you want to govern, you have to have policies that people will vote for.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Let's move on then to energy. This is something which exercises a lot of people. I'm not actually going to be talking about nuclear, but it would be nice to know actually your view of nuclear while we pass.
Okay.
Are you for it or against it?
I am for nuclear power, which is a controversial view for some anyway. I believe it's part of a massive sort of mix of energy that we require to secure our energy supplies. I would very much like to see much more green and sustainable energy options, but nuclear is what we are getting in spades here in some
sense. We can't change it. So.
What I'm very, very annoyed about is actually the deal that the current Tory government did, which pegged the price at ridiculously high levels, so we're going to be paying over the odds for that energy that's generated at Hinkley.
Well, that actually nicely leads me on to the point I was trying to make here. Again, I'm quoting your manifesto. We're talking really of gas and electricity. The manifesto says, we will introduce immediately an energy price cap Now, this is a private industry, so how can you cap its cost if you've got private businesses all competing to actually produce that energy for you?
Okay. Well, let's go back to...
I found that difficult to accept when I read it.
Let's go back to 2015.
Yeah, sure.
When energy companies deliberately overcharged the people of this country £2 billion. We can set a cap that covers the cost of generating the energy and allows a fair profit for those organisations without actually crippling the industry, as some people have said. I thought it was a disgrace that the Big Six were allowed to get away with it, and that's a government failure, and that's at the feet of the Tories and the Lib Dems, who were in control from 2010 to 2015. You know, 2015, £2 billion in overcharging.
But didn't the current government, or rather the previous government, try to cap the products themselves, and it didn't work?
I think we introduced...
It leaves the less consumer choice, doesn't it?
I think... Well, I'll wind that back. Consumer choice is great, but the reality is it doesn't matter who supplies you, whether it's EDF, whether it's Southern Power, whether it's Scottish and Southern, and all of the many different organisations.
Sure.
Electricity and gas come out of the holes in the wall.
Comes from the same place, yes.
And it's all generated in the same places. It's just a question of this extra layer. And that extra layer actually costs the consumer more. Energy costs have risen by 40%.
I know. I'm a payer myself.
In my mind, it makes sense to me that we can do something to make it easier for normal working people to actually live and survive.
Yeah. Well, actually, it leads on to the other manifesto commitment in this area, that it states that energy business will be taken back into public ownership or renationalised. Are you in favour of that?
Absolutely.
You are.
I'm a slightly old-fashioned Labour bod when it comes to that. Now,
but wasn't one of the reasons that denationalisation took place in this and many other industries was to make it more competitive? Are we not going backwards?
I think I might take a slightly different view on the nationalisation of our energy industries, and look at it and say that actually my opinion is that it was a good Tory ruse to make money for the people at the top, and if you are sort of lucky enough to own sort of a large amount of shares in an energy company, you're doing extremely well, thank you very much. The reality is, when people are trudging down to the local corner store to charge up their electricity and gas cards, because the reality is they can't actually afford to pay a quarterly bill because it's so expensive, they have to budget on a week-to-week basis, it doesn't work for the average person.
I can see your point, Martin. What occurred to me, though, when I was preparing these notes on the energy sector, was if you're trying to cap the price, and I agree, I think any party would like to see prices at a much more level playing field than they are at present, instead of galloping up every year. If you're trying to do that, there are so many unknowns that affect the price of these things. I mean, who knows what's going to happen to the oil or the gas which is coming into our country from overseas in the event of wars, in the event of takeovers of power or whatever. Any number of things can affect the price of that commodity. And I think, are you not tying one hand behind the backs of the companies providing this in the UK by saying, no, you cannot charge more than this if most of their costs are in fact out of their control? It worries me a bit, that.
You can't not do something because of the what ifs. Because if we live in fear of the what ifs, then nothing ever progresses. So yes, the energy industry is very, very volatile, which is one of the reasons why, also in part of the manifesto, is a commitment to the investment into sustainable and renewable energies that we can generate here in the United Kingdom. Yes. We've seen here in Taunton Deane, you've got massive massive investment in solar. We haven't seen it much wind, but we have seen sort of some very, very interesting sort of developments in sustainable living, in houses that are energy efficient. I want to see more of that, and that's something that sort of I know that when we were here at the climate change hustings here in Wiveliscombe the other night, several people mentioned is the fact that we've got lots and lots of things that we could and should be doing. It takes government to do that, and the current government hasn't been.
Okay, the last thing on energy before we move on to something else is fracking. Now, I know that this is something which the Labour Party in their manifesto say they're very much against. Is that your personal view?
Yes, I'm very much against fracking. I'm worried about the effects that it will have on our environment. I'm worried that the science, although sounding very good, is not yet fully
developed.
But
the jury's out, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, I would say is, we've talked about energy security. The fact is that fracking might provide us with energy supplies here in the UK. If someone can convince me that the science is sound and that the dangers that are potentially there are not actually real, then I would be willing to reconsider that point.
Only yesterday, in fact, on the news, I heard the comment made that due to the high success of fracking in the US, several of the nuclear power stations are closed down, which is interesting, isn't it?
I haven't seen that report.
No, that was on the news, on Radio 4's news bulletin in the morning.
I was out campaigning early yesterday, and then obviously had the hustings last night, and then I went home and watched the six-way debate opposed to the seven-way debate.
Yes, I only saw edited highlights of it. How do you think your leader came out?
I think he came across as an extremely reasonable and very prime ministerial individual.
What was interesting, I think, was the comment made by the broadcasters that outside the venue was a very vociferous group of young people saying Tories out. So they were obviously very keen to support your cause.
Well, You've said that. Jeremy Corbyn's been quite an interestingly divisive figure across many parts of our country, I would say. But the one thing you can say very much about Jeremy is that he has engaged with a lot of people who have not been involved in politics for a long, long time. And the fact is that there are people that believe in sort of what he's got to say. Mm. And what he's got to say is what is in the Labour Party manifesto.
Even young people who are new to politics.
New to politics. And I ping that back to the Lib Dems. The Lib Dems had a very, very big young Lib Dem grouping who felt very, very let down when the Lib Dems went into coalition with the Conservatives because they felt their ideals had been given up. So
it's probably a two-way street between the two parties on a number of things. That was one of them.
But the fact is that people are passionate about their politics. Mm-hmm. We've had a number of big votes over the last few years. We've had Brexit. We've had a general election. And all of that has re-engaged people into politics. People are getting used to going out and voting again, which can only be a good thing. Over half. 500,000 young people registered to vote in the run-up to the deadline a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure that that's got got people in all parties going, scratching their heads and going, now, which way are they going to vote?
That's a $64 question. Right, we'll take a little break, I think, and ask Barry to put on some music. We'll come back and talk about Social Security after a bit of music. Thank you. to 10 Radio 105.3 FM and streaming. And we're having an election interview with the Labour candidate for Taunton Deane constituency, Martin Jiven. Martin, let's go on to social security now. I'm looking at the manifesto words, and it says Labour will guarantee the triple lock for pensioners. And that's something, you're still in the clothes of Conservatives on that, and they, of course, are abandoning it. Why do you think you're keeping it?
Well, the fact is that our pensioners deserve that triple mm-hmm. lock.
I agree with you, but why? It's so expensive, isn't it? I think this is the reason the Tories want to abandon it, but you obviously want to grab hold of it.
So is it too expensive? Are our older people not worthy of protecting the hard earned income?
I agree with you completely. They are, of course.
They have worked hard for over the years. Now the reality is that when you abandon the triple lock, people's incomes will fall, and people's life will potentially suffer from that. Then if you tie that in with the means testing of winter fuel allowances, the removal of a number of other things, older people are getting a raw deal from the Conservative manifesto.
Interesting, though, that pensioners have been one of the mainstays of Conservative support. And it seems rather strange that they should abandon that triple lock. But, however, I think the point they're trying to make is that everyone must bear part of the cost, part of the pain, if you like, of getting this thing right.
So more austerity then, which seems to be a line the Tories are not actually using, but yeah. When you actually read the details,
I'm not advocating that we do lead the triple lock. Don't get me wrong, but I'm simply saying that's the argument which they're putting forward. A second quote I've got here from your social security section says here, we will restore confidence in workplace pensions. I didn't know we'd lost confidence.
Okay, so let's look at a variety of changes in pensions over the years.
This was my work, so I know a bit about pensions.
If you look at I currently work for a care organisation, mm-hmm. And I won't go into the details, but I'm signed up to a workplace pension, and that last month took £4.93 as my pension contribution for mm-hmm. a month of very hard work.
Sure.
Now that's a very, very low amount, and the reality is that's not going to give me a pension that's actually worthwhile.
But surely isn't it in, sorry to interrupt there, but isn't it in your interests and the interests of everyone else to put enough into their pensions to make them worthwhile? You know it's a small amount. Are you personally doing something about putting more in?
I can't afford to put more in.
Right, okay.
And that's the reality.
Okay.
Your average person who's earning £7.80 yep. something an hour
yeah.
is living day to day, week to week.
Yeah.
Investing in your future, which is important, and putting money into a pension is the last thing on their mind. If you're struggling to put food on the table, if you're struggling to pay for your energy that we were talking about a moment ago, the reality is that putting money into a pension pot is the last thing you're going to do. We want to.
I know it's something you do defer, Martin, because I've been trying to talk to people about their pensions all my working life, and I know all the arguments that come back about I can't afford it or it's a long way ahead. But the fact remains that when people do get to that point in time, the state benefit isn't nearly enough to keep you going. You've got to have some private pension going. And I think employers quite often recognise that, from my experience, by putting in place a pension scheme. Now, they pay an awful lot more than the staff do. I don't know whether you realise that, do you?
I do indeed. You do? I do realise that.
Yeah, but, absolutely. But you see, if the employers have got the will to do it, and the government recently have been pushing that point, then surely there is a recognition there already. So what are Labour trying to achieve on that point?
Let me come back on that.
Yeah, sure.
Last night at the business hustings, yes. Someone complained that they were having to pay a contribution for the pensions
right,
for their employees, yeah. which disappointed me. Now, the point you're making is that the state pension levels are at historically low level in purchasing power. The And the reality is that although pensions have risen within the welfare sector, we've paid in sort of as part of our sort of taxes and national insurances. We all pay in that direction. What we want to, when we talk about workplace pensions, which is where we started, people don't have confidence in them. We've seen the collapse over the years of a number of very, very large pension schemes. We've seen the British Home Stores disaster, where there was not enough money in the pension scheme after it went plop, which led to Philip Green paying back in tons and tons of money, but then liability coming back onto the government for the rest of the missing money. You can also look at local government pension, which is something I'm very, very much aware of, which has been described as this gold-plated sort of wonder. The reality is local government pensions are a contributions-based one from the employee as well as the employer, and they've been squeezed as well. And you can get me started on what I think about the way that the current government has demonised public service workers, and we'll be here for another 3 hours, and I know we've only got a short while. So people don't necessarily have confidence in the pension scheme because they've seen these big disasters, but they also don't have confidence in pension schemes because actually when you look at your average person who's earning a low wage, they don't see the benefit. Now, part of what we need to do and encouraging that is the fact that we need to show that there is a benefit in pensions. And I don't disagree with you at all that we all need to be saving for our future. But when you haven't got that money to save, it's a challenge.
Unfortunately, it's been a live today society, and they don't think towards the end of their lifetimes they're going to need a lot more income. But let's move on, shall we? I can see where you're coming from. The next point, which I picked out from the manifesto here, limiting universal credit to only the first two children of a family is an attack on low-income families. This is a quote from your manifesto. Does that mean that only low-income families will have more than two children? I mean, that's a bit cynical, possibly, but should the state really encourage families to have a lot of children just so they can live on the social security benefits rather than sending those people out to work?
Well, I think that's a quite a harsh way.
But that's what they're saying. Okay. Would you advocate universal credit for every child, if it's a dozen children?
So child benefit traditionally was a benefit that was paid directly to the main caregiver of the children. It wasn't, and with the introduction over the years of the changes in that way, and with universal credit, it's all been encompassed into this one sort of all-encompassing benefit. Now, there's lots of good to be said about universal credit, but not universally. Now, the reality is that it's only people on low incomes who are going to be getting universal credit, child benefit is something that was limited to two, but the reality is that there are lots and lots of families out there that have more than two children. I'm not saying that that's encouraging people to have more children to claim benefits, because that is a ridiculous statement.
Well, I agree it's a ridiculous statement, but it is a reality in life that some families, I'm only saying it's a minority, that we've seen on television programmes and so forth, actually do produce large families and don't go out to work.
There are some people within our society who need sort of support in the way they live. The fact is that the people you see on television are a ridiculously small amount, and television sensationalises thing. There are people that unfortunately actually live very, very chaotic lifestyles. And part of what I believe is that the state should provide a good safety net to ensure that they don't fall down. But if a parent is living a chaotic lifestyle, why should the children suffer?
Yeah, I agree with that. Let's move on a little bit further into health and social care. Again, a quote from your manifesto says that guaranteed access to treatment within 18 weeks must be there for everybody. Now, is that a pipe dream, do you think? I mean, this is something the present government and previous governments have been seeking to do for a long time, isn't it? Why suddenly do you think that, that Labour could fulfil that pledge?
Well, it was a pledge and a policy in the previous Labour governments, and you saw waiting lists drop, you saw treatment outcomes and quality of life improve.
But we're still not there, are we? We're a long way. I mean,
So we're not there, but let's have that ambition. Mm-hmm. Let's not sort of criticise an ambition.
Oh, not criticising it. I'm saying that the present government is saying the same thing. They've been pouring money in as well, and it still hasn't got to that magic 18-week period, has it?
Well, I disagree with you saying that they've been pouring money in. You know, the majority of NHS services have been on a standstill budget for a long time. They had protected standstill budget, whilst other parts of society have had slashes. But the fact is, if you have a standstill budget, that's a cut in real terms.
Yeah, I agree with you. The manifesto also goes on to say you will guarantee that all patients will be seen in A&E within 4 hours. The present government again has tried that one and it doesn't seem to be working. How are you going to match that guarantee? How are you going to perform that guarantee?
Well, the reality is that to do that you need more people and more facilities within A&E, and so that's investing in people, that's investing in facilities, but it's also investing in the other areas to stop people going into A&E.
Yeah.
We've seen issues around GP surgeries, not being able to see patients. We've got issues around trying to ring 111 for advice and support. I had to ring 111 for somebody not so long ago and was promised a 12-hour callback. Where we are at the moment is that we've got lots and lots of hard-working people within the NHS who are trying extremely hard to deliver a quality service, but there's not enough people and there's not enough facilities for them to do it.
Yeah, I go along with that one. Next quote I've got here is Labour will commit to over $30 billion in extra funding over the next Parliament. This is to the NHS, obviously, by increasing income tax for the top 5% of earners. And then, interesting, this is the phrase that hit me, and by increasing tax on private medical insurance. Now, that was a new one on me. Are you familiar with that from the manifesto?
I read it.
How does that work?
It's not something that I'm completely aware with, and I'd love to say I was, but the reality is that...
I thought private medical insurance was, in fact, there to help the NHS by people making their own provision, if you like. It's not something which is a luxury for the very wealthy. Quite often it's working families who take out these insurances for the very reason that they do want to get faster and better treatment for their families.
Well, as I said, it's not an area I'm familiar with, and I'm not going to sort of try and give you a snowball answer, because I'll dig myself into a hole and I'll say something that's wrong. And politicians do a lot of that, and I'm not going to say that I know it, or I'm not saying it's a good idea or a bad idea. It's not something that
$30 billion over the next. Extra funding over the next Parliament is what they are promising, with or without top-up from private medical insurance.
And we know that £30 million is desperately needed.
Yeah, but billion.
Billion, sorry.
Not million.
Yes, billion. £30 billion.
A bit different. There's also a note here that Labour promises they will set up a national care service, which you alluded to a bit earlier, for those needing social care. And the manifesto says in the first years, our service will require an additional £3 billion every year. It also says we'll seek consensus on how the cost will be shared or funded. Options include, and this is what they say, a wealth tax, an employer care contribution, or a new social care levy. So what does all that mean to our local constituents, do you think?
Well, what it means at the top is that we recognise that the current care system is creaking at the seams. We've got lots of people receiving care in their homes that actually should be in residential provision because there's no residential provision. We've got lots of people who are remaining within the hospital system because there's no provision for them to be discharged. And the reality is that we're pushing the problems along. Now, what does this mean financially? Well, as you said, we don't know. We will seek a consensus. And
it's the way is that they're suggesting raising the money, though, employer care contributions. Does this not sound like an increase in NI or the equivalent of from employers, do you think? Which, again, will push up costs, won't it?
Again, as you've said, it's not specifically set out. But the reality is that if we want our care services, our health services, our infrastructure, our public transport, and everything else to function, we need to fund it properly. And we've squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and we've possibly squeezed too hard now. And we're seeing the fact that let's look at Musgrove Park a couple of years back, where they had something in the region of over 200 and something beds blocked because there was no provision within the community sector to discharge these nearly well and mostly well individuals. That costs us even more. So the fact is that if we can get the care system working, we can actually then get the NHS working, and that will actually cost us less because the cost of a bed in Musgrove Park is a lot more expensive than seeing someone in their own home.
It is. I quite agree. I mean, fundamentally, you've just got this difference between, on one side of the fence, a party saying, we can't really afford any more, we want to put more in, we've got to spend the money very, very carefully. On the other side of the fence, we're saying, yes, we'll put more money in. It's a question of where the money comes from. You only get what you pay for. That's true, isn't it?
And absolutely. And at the moment, if you only get what you pay for, at the moment we're paying less for our services, and we're seeing that our services are suffering.
Yeah. Let's move on to Brexit, shall we? This is, again, a hot potato.
Thank you very much, and I'm now going to leave.
The quote in the manifesto is, "We will end Theresa May's reckless approach to Brexit." Now, what does that mean?
I think we've seen that Theresa May's calling of Article 50 before we actually knew what we wanted from a Brexit deal was reckless. We've also seen that no one can actually agree on what the Brexit deal is going to look like. And we've also seen the fact that even within her own party, there are people saying we are going to leap out of Europe without knowing where we're leaping to. And if you leap off a cliff, you need to know that there's something underneath that's going to catch you. And I'm quoting from the manifesto now. It talks about the cliff edge. And one of the things that we've mentioned in the manifesto is that we will look at the Great Repeal Bill, and we will actually look at what is good about the European legislation and keep that, because I was pro Remain. I believe in the European ideal. I believe that we should have remained. The fact is that Cameron and Osborne's own internal party difficulties which led them to go for this this Brexit sort of vote without actually having any idea about what the question should be. Then we got this ridiculous position where it's divided the country, and I don't like living in a divided country. I accept that we've taken that in, it's a democratic decision, so I don't agree with the Lib Dems that we should have another referendum on sort of whether we should remain. I do believe, I sound worryingly like 2010, I will agree with the Lib Dems and some of the other parties that whatever deal that we now get possibly requires another vote.
Okay. We've got so many things I haven't covered so far, and only about 10 minutes left, so I'm only going to move on very quickly to some of these things and miss out some of the points. Housing is something which has been raised by several of our listeners, actually. The cost of tenancies, for example, people going into tenanted accommodation has gone up an awful lot. We've been given quotations of huge increases in costs. The manifesto says Labour will invest in building over 1 million new homes. It says by the end of the next parliament, we'll build at least 100,000 new council and housing association homes per year. Well, obviously, those two will go towards combating this high cost of rental. And then it also says we will start work on a generation of new towns. Now, what does that mean for our area, do you think?
Well, we've seen that Taunton Deane and Taunton itself has had the garden town status. There's a massive housing crisis. There are millions of people who cannot afford but we've seen the developments here in Taunton Deane, this sort of donut ring, which I think has been described, of new housing that doesn't have any community facilities, no shops, no places to congregate. And so the idea is that, yes, we recognise that there is much to be done, but a whole new town development, rather than trying to ram in sort of rabbit hutch boxes around existing towns that do not have the facilities to support all of these extra homes, is a good idea. What it looks like in effect is whether we're going to see a new Milton Keynes, I don't know, but the reality is we need more housing, but we need to do that in a sympathetic way to the places that we live.
We've certainly seen a lot of housing development in Taunton and Wellington in the last few years, haven't we? And also to an extent here in Wythie, but mainly those two centres.
We have, and when you look at one point, it was all like, there's 4 inches of green space there. Let's put five houses in that gap. But the one thing that all of this development hasn't done is hasn't provided cheap rents and social housing.
I don't want to interrupt you there, but coming on to your point just then, there's a point in the manifesto that says Labour will make 3-year tenancies the norm with an inflation cap on rent rises, which really is what you, I think, alluded to just then. You are going to fix the cost.
There's insecurity of tenancy within the private rental sector. Lots of people live on a 6-month tenancy, and that's hard to live by. You can't create a home on a 6-month tenancy, and people are afraid to complain. So if you complain that you need something repaired, and your landlord is not as scrupulous as they might be, at the end of the 6 months they just tell you that your tenancy is not renewed, and then you're off finding a new home once again. 3-year tenancies seem very reasonable. Once the rent is set, it seems fair that it's set at inflation and not above inflation.
Okay, let's move on quickly then to security and the police. Labour are pledging to provide 10,000 more police officers and 3,000 more prison staff. You've mentioned, obviously, that we've mentioned this several times today in our interview, that funding is going to be needed for these, but Labour seems to be saying in its manifesto that it's going to take money from the top 5% of earners in this country, and maybe some of the big businesses who may not be paying enough tax, for example. But surely there's going to be a gap there, isn't there? There's, even hitting those two areas, you're still looking at much bigger areas of income that are needed to fund all of these major projects you're talking about.
Tories have cut 20,000 police officers. Yeah. We're pledging to reintroduce 10,000. I'd like to see us reintroduce more. If you look at Taunton Deane, we've lost our 24-hour police station.
Yeah, sure.
We've lost a lot of police officers. We've lost community support officers who are important to our communities. Yeah. Yes, we have stated where we're going to try and get the money from, and I'm not an economics expert. The reality is I'm a local guy who believes that I will represent the people of Taunton Deane, the people of Wythe Liskerman and 10 parishes as a good and competent member of Parliament. But as a parliament, we bring different people bring different expertises.
Of course, yeah.
So my area of expertise is not purely financial, although I can read a budget sheet and I can tell you sort of where the things are going wrong. But what we've done is we've stated where we're going to attempt to find the money from. If we can clamp down on tax evasion in particular, I mentioned Amazon, Starbucks and the rest of it earlier. The billions and billions of pounds that they have not paid, and then the deals that they've come to pay part of the tax they're owing, Vodafone springs to mind immediately. They paid a minuscule amount of what they owed as an, with an agreement to the government over and above what they should have paid. If people are paying, if big businesses are paying their taxes fairly, then actually we can afford this. And one of the things we've said is that people earning under £85,000 will not feel the effects of this.
Well, can I just bring up this famous little piece of paper that you looked at a bit earlier? It was a clipping from one of the national papers over the last week, and it's quoting the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And I quote here, Labour will raise taxes to their highest level since just after the Second World War, and ordinary families will take a hit, economists said yesterday. In a damning assessment of Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto wish list, the Institute for Fiscal Studies said the party should drop the pretense that tax rises were victimless and everything can be paid for by someone else. And it says here it's going to be the highest level of taxation since 1949 if you put into place all of these spending plans.
Well,
there's quite a statement from an independent institute, isn't it?
Well, the Institute of Fiscal Studies is an interesting one. They've also criticised the Tory manifesto spending plans. That's a clipping from the Daily Mail, I did say Daily Mail has never been a friend of the Labour Party. So a couple of points from that. I don't think we've actually said that victimless is the wrong word, but I don't think we've actually said that raising taxes for higher earners. Yes, we know that they will feel that. There's no denying it, and we know that businesses will say that paying their fair share of the tax burden is a challenge, but that takes it out of shareholders' pockets as well. The reality is that we have one of our most progressive manifestos in a long, long time. You mentioned that earlier, that it's sort of got a lot of good stuff in there.
It's a big wish list there, isn't it?
But what's wrong with a
wish
list?
Nothing wrong at all. You've got to pay for it somewhere. That's all I'm saying.
What's wrong with having, big ideas? We've said how we're going to pay for it, and we're going to try very, very hard to make it as fair as possible. But we live in a big society, and it's one of those. And I'm going to quote the manifesto for the many and not the few.
Okay, Martin, thank you very much. We've got to wind it up there. Time is running out, but thank you very much for your time. It's been a very interesting discussion. Can I wish you and all the other candidates the very best of luck on June the 8th. And while I'm just mentioning the other candidates, I've got to name them here. Rebecca Powell, Conservative, Gideon Amos, Lib Dem, Alan Dimmick, UKIP, and Clive Martin, Green Party. And all of these interviews will be taking place this week and will be broadcast again by Ten Radio. Again, thank you, Martin Jevon, for coming in. Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure.